You're listening to Mr. Open Banking, the only podcast dedicated to exploring the open banking movement. Whether you're a financial expert, banking executive, or everyday consumer, open banking affects everyone and will change the way we interact with our money. I'm A.L. Savan, your host. This episode is brought to you by Ozone API, unlocking the power of open finance all over the world. The road to open banking in North America has been a rocky one. While the U.S. wins the prize for most dramatic, the story in the true North has been equally volatile. That is the tale we are here to tell. The story of open banking in Canada. It began all the way back in 2017, when the Canadian government first announced its intention to explore the benefits of open banking. This moment marks the regulator's earliest signal that something was coming, prompting the largest banks to start holding meetings on the matter. The years that followed marked many milestones. 2019 saw the release of a popular paper, raising the volume on an anxious market. In 2021, the government published a landmark report, including a consumer-focused name change and an ambitious launch date. In 2022, a national lead was appointed, former Mr. Open Banking guest Abraham Tachian, who met with industry leaders and assembled a roadmap. Then, in late 2023, the government introduced the Consumer-Driven Banking Act, Canada's first open banking legislation. The act was officially passed on June 20th, 2024. Things looked promising until politics entered the picture. At the beginning of 2025, amid political scandal, the Canadian Prime Minister resigned. Parliament was suspended, halting work on all new legislation, including the crucial second part of the Consumer-Driven Banking Act. Then, an election is held, and a new Prime Minister appointed, former Governor of the Bank of England, Mark Carney. He announces plans to invest in national infrastructure and innovation, sparking hope among Canadian open banking supporters that consumer-driven banking would rise again. To learn what happens next, we turn to our guest. On this episode, recorded at Open Banking Expo Canada in Toronto earlier this year, I speak to someone who has been at the center of this story since its inception. She sits at the helm of one of the most prominent banking infrastructure providers in Canada. And she is going to take us through the rest of our story on our season finale of Mr. Open Banking Live. You're listening to Mr. Open Banking, the only podcast dedicated to exploring the evolution of open banking around the world. I'm your host, A.L. Savan, broadcasting live from Toronto at the 2025 Open Banking Expo Canada. For this session, I am joined by Saba Sharif, Senior Vice President and Chief Strategy, Product and Innovation Officer at SimCorp, a key strategic technology provider to some of the largest banks in Canada. At SimCorp, Saba oversees multiple teams responsible for designing and launching innovative products that address industry-wide challenges like settlement, payments, and, most recently, open banking. Saba, thank you for sitting down with me today.
Thank you, Al. It's a pleasure.
Why don't we start
by bringing our listeners up to date on where open banking stands here in Canada. Give us a brief history of the Consumer-Driven Banking Act.
Oh, can I go back before the Consumer-Driven Banking Act?
As far back as you like.
Awesome. Well, if you think, and not to date yourself or myself, AL, like in 2019, that's the first time that the Canadian government actually put out calls. And I still remember this. They were asking the industry for their opinions on privacy and how that could be impacted or improved through open banking legislation. That was all the way back in 2019. Obviously, the UK was further ahead with their PSD regulations. Then you get into more recently, the first fall economic statement back in, was it 24, I believe, to now, to your point, the Consumer-Driven Banking Act. It set the wheels finally in motion after years of consultations, after years of study. And where we are now in 2025 is the first set of open banking laws have received royal assent. They've actually passed. And that does a few things. It's anointed the entity that's going to oversee the implementation of open banking, the Financial Consumer Agency of Canada. It's given them the authority to do a couple of things, appoint a lead, a senior deputy commissioner, the ability to additionally select a technical standard and put in the wheels in motion for the next phase, which will include determining accreditation criteria, hopefully a timeline and a mandate, hopefully liability regimes and dispute mechanisms going forward. So budget has been assigned, people are being assigned, hopefully standards will be named and we'll move forward. So that's kind of where we're at. Obviously a lot yet to be done, but we've actually had our first regulatory movement, I would say.
And that first piece of regulation, part one of the Consumer-Driven Banking Act, received royal assent on June 20th, 2024. So about a year ago, almost a year ago today. But some stuff happened since then. Canada underwent a turn of what you might describe as political turmoil. What happened and where did that leave the Consumer-Driven Banking Act?
Preceding the June 24 implementation was the fall economic statement, where budget was assigned, that then allowed the government to put forward the legislation and then receive a royal assent. We all anticipated that there would be a Budget Implementation Act too, which would follow, and it would include many of the things that they just talked about. So what happened is well known. Something down south happened first, I would say, and that drove a significant shift in our own political landscape. There was Parliament prorogued, so there's not going to be any legislation coming in that time frame. You have a new sitting government that immediately called an election. So again, no major legislation is going to be put forward. But now we're at that stage where the government has every right and every ability to actually implement Budget Implementation Act 2. Now, the timing for that is dictated, and I'm no regulatory expert, but the soonest would be fall or spring. And those are your two opportunities to implement the remainder.
So to reflect that back, fall economic statement in 23 provided a commitment and a budget. The first part of the act was attached to the Budget Implementation Act, which received royal assent in June of 24. Then Justin Trudeau, then Prime Minister, steps down, Parliament becomes prorogued, and the second part of the Budget Implementation Act, which included the second part of the Consumer-Driven Banking Act, was suspended. Canada went through its own election. We now have a new Prime Minister, Mark Carney. What, if anything, has he said about the Consumer-Driven Banking Act? Anything direct, indirect?
Yeah, and it's a great question. So you have to go back to, from what I've seen and heard, Mr. Carney's activities when he was actually part of the Bank of England, where he was a proponent. He oversaw much of the implementation of open banking in the UK. From our understanding, and there haven't been a lot of public statements, we actually heard from the FCAC commissioner on stage today at the Open Banking Expo that there is a commitment, and it feels like a renewed commitment to its implementation, which is so important. While not having stated anything publicly about open banking, what we have heard the Prime Minister say is that this government will prioritize nation-building infrastructure. And to me, from a digital perspective, this is great nation-building infrastructure. Even if open banking never achieves some of the lofty promises that are out there about use cases and completely digitizing everything we do within our financial lives, it's innovation. It's a catalyst. It has the opportunity to drive momentum forward towards a new digital economy. I think that's really important. Like, we need to take every step we can rather than kind of staying status quo and stagnant. That's not an option, not in this world. You spoke earlier on stage about AI and the impact of AI in our lives today and what the possibilities could be in the future. So to me, I mean, a long way of answering your question, but what did the Prime Minister say about open banking? He certainly has greater familiarity with it than previous, let's say, politicians. And you know, we're hopeful. Those of us who are in the industry for this time are hopeful that it will be something that is prioritized.
Let's start to peel the onion on the Act itself. You mentioned that part of the Act was a commitment to an oversight body, the Financial Consumer Agency of Canada, FCAC. We heard today from that regulatory body that they were bullish on the file, that they wanted to accelerate their efforts. And despite the political turmoil, they have budget in hand. Rather than the relatively meager budget from the 2023 fall economic statement, they now have a budget of approximately $44 million that they are eager to apply. Is that correct?
That's it. You nailed it. And the original budget was roughly, I think, falling for $5 million, if I recall. AL, that's not significant by any means. Now, that has to be seen in context as well. There are already people working within the bureaucracies on open banking. And so this would be incremental dollars that they could spend on consultations, proof of concepts, additional research activities. So $44 million is significant. And with that, we hope to see movement. We hope to see movement on the really open areas of the file that are critical to being answered. So this would be the most significant movement that we had seen in that first Budget Implementation Act 1. And now you're going to need to see that ongoing. So that will allow the government to hire the staff necessary to understand the framework more deeply. Department of Finance has already done a significant amount of work. I thought that something else that was important to note is it's been the Department of Finance that has largely, as you know, been leading this file for many years, working with our former open banking lead, Abraham. And what the government actually outlined was that the Department of Finance would continue and support the implementation with the FCAC. So we're not starting from scratch, because that would not be helpful and that would just delay us. So that was another kind of key element of this, is that there's really an implementation agency, an oversight agency, but supported by the work that the DOF has already done.
Let's discuss some of the specific aspects of the Act. Around the same time frame, our neighbors to the south, the U.S., passed their own open banking regulation known as Section 1033. But in many ways, the Canadian approach differs significantly from the approach taken by the U.S. I'd like to discuss some of the elements that make the Canadian approach unique. Let's start with reciprocity. What is stated in the Consumer-Driven Banking Act and supportive documentation around reciprocity?
Yeah, oh, you went deep. Well, can we start first with the fact that it's just a positive, AL, that reciprocity is even mentioned? That was one of the biggest failings I ever felt it in the previous in UK implementations, that it didn't contemplate reciprocity. You mandate the CMA 9, get live by a certain date, just get your data out. But other entities which have like data, which really enable a full ecosystem for consumers, they weren't mandated. So at least, and I'm happy to see in this implementation, there is an expectation of reciprocity here in Canada, which I think is hugely important. We hear that all the time. It has to be a give to get. Without it, you're going to create an uneven playing field. And at the end of the day, the consumer is going to suffer. Sure, I've got my data from this organization, looks and smells just like this, but this other organization I can't get it from because they're not mandated to. So I thought that was a notable difference.
And just so that our listeners are clear, give to get, reciprocity means that if you want to be a data consumer, then you have to be a data provider. That means all those fintechs out there that are saying, I'm going to scoop up all of the bank's customers, well, you now have to provide data back. Likewise, the banks that are saying, whoa, I don't want to lose all my customers, can be told, don't worry about it. Those fintechs have to share their data back with you. Is that right?
Yeah, that's exactly what it means. Now, whether or not those are the outcomes that actually get realized is a bit of a TBD in my books, but it is very much to create a level playing field, really. But it's about consumer data rights. That's really what this is. If we say the fundamental, or one of the fundamental principles behind open banking is a form of a universal customer data right, I shouldn't just have the right to share data because it's one organization versus another. It should be my data. The data is what's at play here. And reciprocity is a way to enable and enforce that. So for me, it's less about how a fintech views it or as a bank views it. It's like, how should the consumer view this? And how are we taking care of the consumer in that case? And so it is exactly like you described, and it should reach many of those outcomes. Doesn't matter who you are. It's going to come down to the data scope. That's really what's important, because reciprocity at the end of the day, is it your balances the same, or the same types of accounts? What data are we actually talking about mandating and sharing?
So what data are we actually talking about mandating and sharing? Even though both the U.S. approach and the Canadian approach mirror what you see in many other regions in terms of, let's call it the basics, account balances and transactions, product information. What are some of the things that make the Canadian approach different in terms of data scope?
Yeah, so you nailed it in terms of your typical transaction data, your balances, et cetera, across your savings, your checking accounts, deposit accounts, basically. I think one of the interesting things is the call out for accounts like mortgages, as an example, line of credit. So a broader view into your lending data. Some people say when you hit that type of account, you're actually moving into open finance. You've kind of gone beyond basic banking and now into a little bit of the realm of finance. Now, it's not everything. It's not all your wealth and all your holdings, but you're that close to a broader data sharing ecosystem. And that, I think, is a way that this differs. In the ways that it may not differ to everyone's liking, though, is it's purely read data. And that continues to be the case. No right, no ability to open accounts necessarily, no ability to move money at this stage, at least not mandated through open banking.
Investments are in scope as well, is that right?
Right. Investments as well, you got it. And that's why this goes into, I think, not just we call it consumer-driven banking, but now we're talking about what would typically fall into an open finance ecosystem, where if I can see all of my financial health and wealth, better recommendations, better management, better products that could be offered while still, adhering to the differences and the walls between brokers and whatnot. But that's the key benefit. And I think that's great. So I think what you're highlighting, and as we're talking, there is something to celebrate a little bit there. We often say that in Canada, we should be able to take advantage of the fact that, yes, we're behind. Yes, we are late. But we have the opportunity to learn. And while we may not have gone into right, we are going into a broader scope of data than you would have originally seen in some of the other markets. And I think that's a positive thing. That should give a more holistic view of the customer and allow you to offer them a more holistic set of services.
Although those data scopes were identified by name in the first part of the Act, what we've seen so far in the regulation remains at a very high level. Specifically, there hasn't been any selection of a technical standard. That means that while we may be talking in principle about accounts, transactions, lending products, mortgages, investments, there still isn't any clarity on how exactly that data is represented. Is that something of a next step?
It's critical. And I'll say it's from a few fronts. Exactly as you just said, there's lack of clarity in terms of the data scope. And until you pick a technical standard, you're not going to really know, is a balance just the dollar amount that's in my account? Does it include overdraft? How soon do withdrawals need to be applied to that amount? Like, what is something that, as simple as a balance? And you need the clarity that certain standards that are already out there are actually defining. A technical standard, naming of the technical standard, I think is very important. And just because having a standard is a good thing. You as a consumer, when you log in and you authenticate your account, so many websites now say, do you want to use Google? You want to use your Google account to authenticate, or do you want to use Apple Pay or whatever that is? That experience is consistent. If it was different every time, you'd start to not trust it and you'd impact consumer adoption. So just from a standardization perspective to impact the customer experience and improve it and increase adoption, I think is really important. And then the last reason, it's from an efficiency. That's why standards exist, so that, not five people aren't building it five different ways, creating a hodgepodge mess of connections and networking. So that's kind of the third benefit of getting a technical standard. So I think it's really critical that one get named. In the absence of that, though, we see many in the industry that are moving ahead. As they've selected their own standard And they're rallying behind it. And the nice thing about that work is it's a cross-section of players. It's not just banks. It's not just fintechs. It's not just industry representatives. It's kind of across-the-board representation, recognizing that we can't all do this alone.
It's okay to name that standards body. It would be the Financial Data Exchange, or FDX. Despite the uncertain future of the U.S. regulation at the time of this recording, prior to that uncertainty, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau did, in fact, declare FDX as the selected one of, to be clear, the selected technical standards under their regime. Do you think that Canada is at a point that they are ready to declare for a standard? And do you think FDX is the right choice?
Do I think they are ready? I hope that they are. It is hard for many organizations to start down this path when their current systems are not designed for APIs without knowing if that selection is going to be right or wrong. So very much to your point, FDX is the standard that consistently, whenever we talk to an organization, they're leveraging it. We've leveraged it for our own implementation, you know, to be honest. So would it be great? Absolutely would. It would get rid of the confusion in the market. So I do think it's important very much for that reason. And the other part of FDX, as we know, before the rule was pulled or not pulled, it's hard to tell now these days, FDX was selected as one of the standards in the U.S. So from just a purely interoperability perspective, our largest trading partner, where many Canadians have U.S.-based accounts and vice versa, it would be nice if we could have cross-border data sharing. It would be nice if that was based on a single standard. Now, we'll all always have differences in types of accounts, for sure, but the differences will be minimized because at least the way of communication between those two networks will be very similar.
One other area where the Canadian approach differs from the U.S. approach, the U.S. explicitly said, we will allow for multiple standards, and they selected FDX as one of what could potentially be many. No others were selected, to be clear, but that was their principle. Whereas here in Canada, they said one standard. That was before some of this political turmoil we talked about. Do you think that principle should stand or perhaps be revisited?
I think it should stand. My opinion, I don't see the value of multiple standards. Pick one. Put all your energy behind, because this is not an area of differentiation. Like, it's literally in the name, standard. There's no reason for it to be different or for there to be multiple versions. You're really getting to a closed open banking ecosystem if you have to connect to different people in different ways, and you still got a translation layer. So imagine the effort, especially in the U.S., given the number of financial institutions that are there. We've got a decent number here, but nowhere near the number of financial institutions in the U.S. Let's say there were three standards or four standards or five standards. That means you're integrating in different ways depending on what the other entity has selected as their standard. You're building differently. You're testing. Every time a change is made, you have to test that differently. And yes, there will be entities that will come along and they'll build a capability that helps you normalize amongst different standards. Why spend that money? Why spend that time? Why spend that effort? Put it into going live, and it's easier to do it on a single standard.
That said, FDX is an American organization with a Canadian working group that has done a great job driving membership and adoption in the Canadian market. However, given the state of the relationship, and we'll come back to that, do you think there's a need to create more autonomy for the Canadian part of FDX?
No, I think, as I understand it, that's actually been contemplated. And I think that's a good thing. So to your point, beyond a Canadian working group chapter, a certain number of board seats and representation, if you are FDX, and I think it's fair to say, if you're FDX, and we're a member, we're a supporter for sure, and you want to be selected as the Canadian standard, it doesn't come without expectations. And I think that is a very fair ask. But that ask and achieving that ask would be far less than selecting something brand new, designing from scratch, that would not perhaps be interoperable with the U.S. So it's a bit of a, I don't think it's quite the catch-22, but it's a solvable issue. There are Canadian representatives here as well. We're members of Canadian Task Force. I think you can up that representation for sure so that you don't lose focus, that you don't lose the autonomy that's necessary. Let's say Canada decides to move with right. Well, if FTX is the standard that's been selected for REIT, it would, you know, fall that they'd be the standard selected for right. Wouldn't want that delayed if things aren't moving in the U.S. You talked about the CFPB rule being kind of dead in the water. Well, if that's not going to move ahead, we don't want to be held behind if Canada actually does implement the second Consumer-Driven Banking Act.
Another area where the Canadian approach differs from the U.S. is accreditation. The U.S. regulation section 1033 was essentially silent on the matter, whereas even in the earliest versions of the Consumer-Driven Banking Act, there's an explicit principle that has been longstanding in the Canadian discussions stating there will be an accreditation mechanism, there will be a certification mechanism, and there will be a directory of trusted participants. Your perspective on the Canadian approach to what could broadly be called third-party risk management?
You know, it's interesting. We were speaking earlier with the former members of the UK implementation for open banking. And one of the things that they said was critical to the success in the UK was accreditation and the directory. Standard rules for who got in so that anyone who's engaging doesn't have to worry about whether you're trusted or not trusted. And easy view into the status of those trusted entities. They've been accredited. They still are accredited. They're still good to use. Or no, they're not. All of a sudden, you now need to kill your connections to that entity. That was critical. And I think it's very important that we come forward with a set of accreditation rules. So that's clear. It's clear for those who are looking to participate, those third parties. It's clear for the organizations that are interacting with those third parties. And it's done in a neutral way. That's why I think, you know, whether it's the FCAC or however it's done, is responsible for coming up with that criteria. Now, there's a lot, as you know, AL, that should go into it to really get broad adoption. But I think that's really important. And it's interesting that you said it's kind of like third-party risk management. That's originally how we thought about it as well. It's like, this is kind of like your TPRM activities, and you kind of go through it. What we're learning is it's, yes, many ways that's true, but not always the lens that you put in, because this is about risk and liability. And a typical TPRM, you're going to a vendor, you're like, okay, I'm going to assess them because I'm owning the liability. Well, now, who owns the liability? It moves with the data, obviously, but there's a consumer aspect to it also. And so some of the components that the FCC will be looking at include security, include privacy, include integrity and resiliency, which are really important in order to keep trust into the ecosystem.
You said the L word, liability. You said liability follows the data, obviously.
Yes.
Being a good Canadian, restating the principle in our Consumer-Driven Banking Act. Yet again, a difference with the U.S. approach, which left liability with the data provider. Your perspective on those contrasting approaches to liability.
Yeah, and I imagine that was a view to make things easier on the consumer. Even in other markets, you've seen a portion of the liability initially sit with the data provider, just in terms of redress. So initial redress, data provider takes care of it, and then things get figured out, like who is actually liable, and then it's handled through potentially a dispute. So I can understand why a jurisdiction might approach it from that perspective to keep things easy for the consumer. And that still might be the case. That's more about how you handle it up front versus who actually owns the liability. And I think this is a no-brainer. The end recipient who is providing the service, that liability should absolutely follow the data. Why would it stay with a data provider? Yes, it's their customer, but it's equally the customer of the third party. And the consumer has to have some accountability here as well. You know, we don't talk about it often enough, but if a consumer is agreeing to the current mechanism of sharing data, which is giving away their credentials and allowing their data to be scraped, you can't have it both ways. Now, in fairness, is everyone educated and would they really do that if they really knew what it was about? Probably not, but I think it's an important principle to follow.
We've talked about the regulatory side at length. Let's switch gears a little bit and talk about the market perspective. SimCorp provides open banking capabilities to some of Canada's largest banks. Can you elaborate on the role SimCorp aims to play in the larger ecosystem in Canada?
Yeah, for sure. And I'll just give a little bit of the history on SimCorp. We were formed in about 1996, and it was interesting. The issue that was being solved was a bunch of the banks were facing high costs. They had to invest heavily in check infrastructure. And the view back in 1996 was that checks would be gone. And I'm not writing any checks these days, but they're still around. The concept was shared value, shared economies of scale, if you will, essentially a utility offering. And when we saw open banking coming in other jurisdictions, we were like, okay, I've seen this story before. You're going to ask a number of data providers, whether they be large banks or small banks, mid-tier banks, doesn't matter. You're going to ask them to build a bunch of capabilities, monitor untrusted third parties, run that gamut across a bunch of different connections, update it on an ongoing basis. That's inefficient. If everyone's connecting to everyone one-to-one, it's inefficient. It just is. And so we believe we can help. We can help these data providers get ready for open banking. And that's always been our intent, is to help the ecosystem advance open banking, build APIs, maintain those APIs, create sandboxes, have the documentation, onboard data recipients, so that the data recipients can ultimately get secure access to data purely through APIs. And so that is our intent. We consider ourselves an intermediary. We allow data recipients to connect to a network of data providers, and we allow data providers to provide data to a network of data recipients. At the end of the day, it is really intended to drive consumer-driven banking forward in Canada in a more efficient way. When I looked at this back in 2019, 2020, we interviewed a number of the entities in the UK. One of the comments that was made was aggregators. We're not an aggregator, just to clarify. We may provide value-added services with this aggregated data, but we weren't born to be an aggregator. That was not our intent. And when we spoke to many of the organizations, what was clear was the aggregators were solving the fintech problem or the data recipient problem, that they had to individually connect. Now, in the UK, they all had standards that the banks had to adhere to. They all had sandboxes and documentation that they needed to provide, APIs that they needed to publish, but they still had to connect. So a value proposition for an aggregator existed even in that market, but it solved it only for the recipient. No one was solving it for the data provider. And at the end of the day, this is a bit of a supply-demand issue. If you don't have the supply stood up, and it's not stood up in a good way, and it's not efficient and it's not effective, then the demand is going to get impacted. And so that's really what we initially set out to solve for, is the supply side and help those data providers get ready.
A bit of a provocative question. SimCorp, due to the fact that you have unique access on the supply side to the largest banks, to an enormous number of Canadian deposits, you are sometimes painted as beholden to those large banks, and therefore against the smaller challengers or the broader fintech community. How would you respond to that allegation?
Yeah. Ooh, allegation. I love it, AL. Well, a few things just to clarify. Our open banking solution is a commercial offering. We succeed when the market succeeds. There is no open banking success for SimCorp if a bunch of data sits in a bunch of data provider accounts and doesn't get accessed. That's not eliminating credential sharing. That's not eliminating screen scraping. That's not creating a network for innovation. So we are offering a solution that is intended to be useful in the market. Doesn't matter if you're a data recipient or a data provider. I can understand the skepticism, and I've talked to many of those skeptics myself, AL. I think when they see that what we are providing is better than the alternative, which is unreliable, can't scale, insecure, what those data recipients are often asking for is exactly what we're providing. And so my answer to that in a maybe a shorter way of the longer answer is, we are not successful if the market is not successful. Our mandate is to get data out and to get that data out in a safe and a secure fashion. And we're willing to even move ahead of everything being fully solved for that very reason. I'd also qualify, there was no given here. In 2019, when we started this initiative, we had to argue for a value proposition to resonate in market, whether that was with data providers or data recipients. No one handed us open banking. We are a commercial entity that's bringing services to market for obviously our benefit, but for really the benefit of the ecosystem.
Which means if fintechs want to connect to banks directly, SimCorp has no special objection. You don't intend to hold their feet to the fire. And likewise, you don't necessarily require the banks acting as a data recipient, the largest banks in a reciprocal environment, to use SimCorp as their aggregator. You are fundamentally agnostic.
We are agnostic. Now, what I will say is it's about choice. So choice goes two ways. If a bank chooses to use SimCorp to get its data out, they should have that right. As long as they're making the data available in a fair and a consistent manner, that should be allowed. As long as, you know, that data is there and available, I don't think you can mandate that someone should be able to go to a bank and say, oh, and I also want it separately from the organization or the gateway that you're using to provide that data. That seems unfair. And then you're really creating a fragmented ecosystem all over again. Now, that's important on the data provider and us as an intermediary to make sure that we are being fair and consistent and transparent in providing that data. For a data recipient, they do not have to use certainly us. There are other ways. We will be intend to be interoperable. We've already done some proof of concepts with other organizations to validate that other organizations that are playing a similar role or aggregators can actually connect to SimCorp and get that data and vice versa. Now, reciprocity is a core principle of our network as well. You don't have to give the data through SimCorp, but you do need to give the data into the ecosystem in order to participate.
Let's try and zoom out a bit and look at Canada at large. It's no secret that as of now, the middle of 2025, Canada-US relations are a little shaky, with an on-again, off-again trade war, and even talk of Canada becoming the 51st state. Our recent prime minister has made his opinion on that known. How do these rather rocky conversations impact the country's position on our open banking strategy?
Maybe it's actually sharpened it a little bit for us. You know, the resolve that there is around this made in Canada for Canada has never been stronger. And I love that. I love that nationalism. I love that passion to drive Canada forward. And it has been a long time. Like, we're even talking about reducing intra-provincial trade barriers, which are crazy and ridiculous. So this is, you know, generating a resolve that is I think, really important. And I love it.
A kind of call to arms.
Call to arms.
Let's double-click on that in a more technical context, interoperability. Earlier in our conversation, you talked about the importance of having a standard that works across borders. However, in this time of what I would say is increasing protectionism globally, perhaps fueled by the U.S.'s protectionism, is there a need for us to pursue more actively interoperability with other countries?
I think that doesn't just apply to open banking. Like, we have got to reduce our reliance on what is an increasingly volatile relationship. And that's not just in technology, that's in physical goods. Now, that takes time. But you know what's easier to do? It's to move data. You don't need to build new rail networks or shipping lanes or fly more stuff over. Data is easier. So for sure, I think this is a great opportunity and perhaps somewhere where we can accelerate sharing data, enabling immigrants to come to Canada more easily, creating output that can be leveraged, AI that can be leveraged in other ecosystems in a way that we're a little bit more comfortable and trusted. And you would be familiar with this, Ale, with the whole data residency questions and concerns. Am I comfortable with having my data in a server in the U.S.? No, I am not. As just as a Canadian, as a citizen, I'm not. And that's not less because they're great, obviously great companies, etc. But I'm not sure that I'm comfortable with the political regime and what might be assumed could be done with that data. So I think that's an important part. What if it's not subject to the same privacy rules that we have here? And I think that's an important thing that we do need to be mindful of.
On a related note, during your talk at the event today, you said that Canada cannot afford to be a digital tenant in someone else's house. What did you mean by that?
I mean what it says. I think we need to own our own destiny, Eyal. while it's great that we've leveraged the learnings from other markets, we are unique in Canada. We don't have the same drivers for things like open banking that they had in the UK. We don't have the same drivers in Australia. And it's important that we learn from other jurisdictions, but we apply what's necessary for our own ecosystem, for our own market, for the success of Canadians. And that means not being a tenant in someone else's house, not being beholden to other regimes and how they've implemented, is really owning our own destiny and driving it.
A common conjecture in open banking circles is that open banking expands into open finance, and open finance expands into open data. How do you see that progression evolving, if at all, in Canada?
It is a common conjecture. I don't think it has to go so linearly. And we chatted about this earlier, how the scope of data is probably a little bit broader here than it has been in other jurisdictions. You could almost say we're getting into open finance already. It isn't just regulated to banking data. But that progression probably starts with a concept of a customer data right, more universally applied to any industry as opposed to just banking, whether that's healthcare, energy, and it can be businesses. It's not always about the consumer. It's about creating innovation amongst and competition amongst businesses as well. And so while I would ideally love to see that expand, I think that's going to take now with the FCAC in place, their own considerations for approaching this a little bit differently and not being fixated perhaps on just banking data and getting it going. It's going to take some interprovincial challenges to address differences in privacy rules, which, you know, we're part of the way there. So ideally, I'd like to see a progression to open data. I think that's really the goal here, is if you imagine a lot of open data, and I think you and I were chatting about this earlier today, when people talk about open data, they assume it's publicly available data. And I think this is a combination, certainly publicly available data, but my data, my health data, my transactions on any ecosystem, maybe the data I've shared or my preferences, my purchases across the board, that's all my data. So I do think that there should be a consideration for that more broadly.
The flip side of open data is the hottest topic in IT today, AI. Although Canada's contribution has been somewhat under the radar, the fact is that many of the top minds in AI are Canadian, including Geoffrey Hinton, the University of Toronto professor who trained many of the top AI practitioners in the world. How can Canada leverage its AI expertise to make its open banking and indeed open data strategy even stronger?
Yeah, and that I think your answer is in the question that you just asked. We need to do exactly that. We need to leverage our AI expertise, our homegrown talent, and actually apply that to open banking. Many of the first use cases, there's, you know, dubious level of success that you'll see in the UK market, were all about personal financial management. Okay, I've got savings goals. Here's where my money is going. If you want to actually save a little bit more, do this. Imagine applying AI to that. Imagine having a very different conversational experience for recommendations. Now, we get a little bit scary sometimes when we go that, because there should still be oversight and regulation against those robo-advisor type capabilities, if you will. But what if we could actually apply that against just not just banking data, but data, health data? You and I chatted about this earlier. And while we joke when everyone says, hey, AI is going to solve for cancer, what if we could share clinical research data more easily, make that more accessible so that you're not just dealing with a localized solution for it, but can leverage the power of a global network? We should find ways to keep our homegrown talent, encourage them, support them, and do some amazing things. And this is back to the conversation we had earlier on trade concerns with our, you know, friends in the U.S. If we're not going to have that same relationship, what if we could be a technological superpower? Even small countries like Estonia have done this. Where there's a will, there's a way. A completely digital. You can be a citizen of Estonia and never have to set foot. Get your EID, you get your citizenship, and they're okay with that. Why can't we do something so bold and so nation-building here?
Let's close on that note by talking about the blue sky future. If Canada does everything right, we accelerate on our consumer-driven banking plans, we incorporate open data into that regime, We complement that with AI technologies that take advantage of that consumer permissioned access. Where will we find ourselves in 5 or 10 years?
We'll find ourselves in a much better place, AL. We'll find ourselves in a democratized, accelerated, advanced technological ecosystem with use cases that you and I haven't even imagined yet. And I think that's the beauty of this. This is an opportunity to be a catalyst for innovation. You'll be in a world where the friction is gone. The friction in opening an account, applying for a mortgage, will be as simple as hailing an Uber, perhaps. And that's a world that we should work towards so that our energies are spent on better and bigger things.
Saba, thank you so much for your time. It's been a pleasure talking to you today.
Thank you, Al. It's a pleasure.
In the time since this interview was conducted, a lot has changed. A new chapter has been added to the Canadian open banking story, and it is a big one. On November 4th, 2025, the government released their budget for the coming year with the title, Canada Strong. As part of their plan, they announced fundamental revisions to the consumer-driven banking framework. The general approach remains largely unchanged, and everything Saba said about the scope of data covered, core principles like reciprocity, and the need for formal accreditation still holds true. However, the changes were significant enough that we couldn't bear to just leave you all hanging. So we reached out to Saba one more time to help guide us through this latest chapter. Other episodes of Mr. Open Banking Live would end here, but this time, we keep going. Saba, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Al. Great to be here.
Let's jump right in. On November the 4th, 2025, a new chapter of the Canadian open banking story began. Why don't you give us a quick summary of what precisely was announced for consumer-driven banking in Canada's new budget?
I think a chapter, AL, is a great way to describe it. If open banking in Canada was a book, I'd probably liken it to Homer's Odyssey, though, in terms of the length and the time it's taken for us to get here. This chapter has got to be the most exciting. So some of the key updates or announcements that I think are relevant for your audience, at least the most impactful ones. Number one, transfer of oversight for open banking from the FCAC to the Bank of Canada. Combined with that, the addition of right access to the mandate for the Bank of Canada to implement, aligning it with an expectation that it would follow real-time rails integration here in Canada. And then timelines, the long-awaited timelines, certainly an indication that by 2026, at least some form of read access would be available here, and then followed shortly thereafter in 2027 with write access. So certainly the most exciting developments we've seen in Canada to date.
Let's go through some of those changes one at a time. Perhaps the most significant of all was the transfer of oversight from the Financial Consumer Agency of Canada, the FCAC, to the Bank of Canada, the country's central bank. Your thoughts on this decision?
We see a lot of synergies with the transfer of oversight to the Bank of Canada, especially when it comes to payments initiation, or at least that form of read and write access. The Bank of Canada already has oversight for payment service providers. That's already been implemented. There's already an accreditation framework that they are leveraging. And so the view from the Department of Finance that they could maybe minimize regulatory burden to help accelerate the adoption and with the focus on payments, I thought was really important and critical. This is not to take anything away from the FCAC, but given the focus on payments and the most value, as you know, AL, has been driven in other markets through the inclusion of payments initiation use cases or general right access. It could include account opening for sure. It's the right thing to do, in my opinion, especially given the focus is on minimizing additional regulatory burden and oversight.
To reflect that back, it sounds like you're saying the rationale for moving oversight to the Bank of Canada is alignment between consumer-driven banking and the various payments modernization efforts that are under the central bank already, like real-time rail and this accreditation of third-party service providers. Your thoughts on this one? Will the approach to payments for accreditation and bringing on third parties work for open banking?
For it to work for open banking, I think it's going to be really important to have a view into what has and hasn't worked in other jurisdictions. That's really important. So I don't think you can take carte blanche what has been leveraged for payment service providers and completely apply that to an open banking use case. And what I mean by that, AL, is if you look at some of the read uses for open banking, as you're well aware, some of them can be very, very simple asks for data that are infrequent in nature, not high volume, sensitive transactional information. So in order for the accreditation framework that's been leveraged to date for RPAA to work in an open banking context, it's important to account for the differences between read and write, the use cases, the types of entities that are going to get involved, the uses of that data, the sensitivity. All those need to be considered for this to be successful.
You mentioned read versus write. So let's go there. To date, after many, many years, Canada's open banking efforts, our consumer-driven banking efforts, have been limited to read access, i.e., get me account and transaction data and some other data. One of the gifts that we got on November 4th was the addition of write access, i.e., payment initiation. And as you described, the efforts that the Bank of Canada has already been putting towards payments, i.e. write, are going to be leveraged to create an accreditation regime for read. But we didn't just get good old payment initiation. Bill payments and switching providers were also explicitly mentioned. Is this a welcome addition or too much too fast? I mean, can we really get there by 2027?
One would argue that we've been at this for 6 years already. And so it's a very fair question. The good news is that in many of the examples that you've shared, there's precedent certainly in other markets. Is it too much too soon? Time will tell. I do think 2027 is an ambitious timeline given all that is already underway. We do have to look at this within the context of real-time implementation currently underway, where a number of organizations are preparing for a implementation date in the coming year. So with that being said, I think it's important to balance these changes, but also to move. We will not be able to progress until we get something out in market. We all know, AL, the value of test and learn. And that test and learn, we really have not had that opportunity in the Canadian market. Is account switching a thing here? Certainly hasn't been without open banking. Most consumers maintain the bank accounts that they started out with when they first graduated university. Is that really going to change that behavior in Canada, or will it just offer more choice for me to have multiple services from different financial institutions? So I think time will tell, but your question was, is it too much too soon? And I would again go back to, well, we've been talking about this since 2019, 2020. It's a welcome change. I welcome the dates. I welcome the inclusion of right access with all the caveats of, we've got to make sure that we're not overly stressing the financial services industry, given the number of initiatives that are already underway.
Provider switching, bill payments, the general tenor around the latest consumer-driven banking update was part of a broader push to increase competition in the financial services sector in Canada. Frankly, a relatively new message for Canadians. What reactions are you hearing from the market?
Maybe this is not even an open banking context, because we're all excited about a lot of the changes that have recently occurred in the financial services industry. We had the acquisition of Laurentian's commercial business by Fairstone Capital. We had National take on the retail accounts. We have EQ Bank making a big play in market as well. So there's a lot of things that are happening that I do believe are going to provide increased choice. And increased choice is a good thing. We should welcome competition. Competition makes you work harder to be the best at your business. And I think it's an important thing. So certainly for a good portion of the market, we're hearing, okay, we've got clarity, we've got dates, we've got scope, let's go. We welcome the competition side. There's still questions to be answered, AL. While as happy as I am that we have dates, that we have clarity and scope, there's still some things that are out there, whether, and well, I'm sure we'll talk about that shortly, whether that's the technical standard or otherwise. Those questions really need to be answered for us to be confident in an implementation date of 2026 or 2027.
Before we jump to the next jobs to be done, let's stop at bank competition. Another big thing that happened in the open banking world since our live interview was JP Morgan Chase deciding to charge fees for access to customer data, causing quite the stir in the US and even in Canada. Meanwhile, our Consumer-Driven Banking Act maintains that the data will be free. Where do you stand on this issue, and where will Canadian banks stand now that JPMC has opened the door?
I had the benefit, AL, of traveling to the UK a few weeks back and speaking to a number of the market participants there. And across both, let's call it sides of the aisle, if we want to go there, from a bank or a fintech perspective, there was a consistent word that was used that I thought that was really interesting, and that was incentives. You have to have the right incentives. The incentives have to be in the right place to drive action and traction. You know, the free product is only going to get you so far. And what JPMC was doing was, at the end of the day, not looking to make a profit on this was the message that they delivered, but they do incur significant costs to maintain their APIs, the security. And again, I'll go back to the UK example. Many organizations that we spoke to, including fintechs, would say that they would happily pay fees to access data if that meant that the service was better. If you look back to the initial disputes that were raised when open banking was first implemented in the UK, many of them were not about someone's actually done something wrong. It's like, the API is not up and running. I can't actually access it. If the incentives are in the right place, then you'll get the right actions. While I don't necessarily expect this to be a revenue generator, and I don't think that would be necessarily appropriate for an organization like JPMC, especially in the when it comes to the basic data and consumer rights there, I can, as a business person, completely understand that if you don't have the incentives in the right place, you're not going to get the outcome that you want. If this is purely a regulatory initiative, like it or not, people will do the bare minimum. So there's something to be said for having an ecosystem where that is considered. And it looks like they've been able to negotiate those contracts and negotiate fees with the market. That is now the precedent in the US. If we're to look further at the US, they have some of the greatest adoption of APIs in market compared certainly to Canada, but other jurisdictions as well. And they've done that actually in the absence of regulations or without regulations. So there's, for me, a consideration there that they did have the right incentives in the right place in order to encourage a move away from screen scraping and credential sharing.
Does that mean that, in your opinion, Canada should change its principle on this question and perhaps the Consumer-Driven Banking Act itself?
What I like about the Canadian framework is that oftentimes it is principle-based. There are many markets where there are precedents for the allowance for fees to be charged. So let's not even just talk about JPMC unilaterally making that decision. But certainly in several Asian markets, the regulators have allowed for fees while monitoring to ensure that they are not overly prohibitive. At the end of the day, the consumer should not pay. But what we're talking about when we move away from credential sharing and screen scraping to APIs, to proper consent, is a far superior product than what exists today. Forget even the data being shared in ways that it shouldn't be shared, APIs are just far better than screen scraping and credential sharing. So that alone is an investment to make sure that they're secure as an investment. So I think the Canadian government should keep that in mind to monitor for the outcomes that it's looking to achieve and ensure that there is allowance at the right level at the right time for the incentives to be appropriate. And that doesn't necessarily need to be at the basic data level AL. There's certain enhanced service levels, enrichments, value-added services, where I expect there would be openness to allow for that and let the free market decide. It's a fine mix of both regulation and oversight with market-driven activities. Remember, this was supposed to be a hybrid implementation in Canada. Perhaps that's an element where the hybrid can come in.
There was another significant big picture move announced by the government as part of the update as well. Something that you had brought up during our live interview. And that was proposed amendments to PIPEDA, Canada's main privacy legislation, to support what sounds like generalized data portability rights. Not just for financial services, not just for financial data, but for all data. Is that right?
That is correct. And certainly exciting, AL. When you think of broader consumer data right, as you know, in Australia, that their open banking regime started with a consumer data right that extended beyond banking and financial services data to telcos, utilities, energy, etc. That's the opportunity that's certainly presented here. And it's interesting because with this reform, this opportunity for reform, it does need to go hand in hand in parallel. So as opposed to a purely consumer data right driven set of legislation pushing open banking forward, what we're talking about is parallel reforms of PIPEDA while open banking's happening. It's going to be really interesting to see how this plays out in the next 2 years. Back to our earlier conversation about the Bank of Canada having oversight. Is the Bank of Canada the right entity to have oversight long-term if the data sharing extends to health data, to energy data, to telco data? That's a question that remains to be answered. I do appreciate the government's approach to balancing it to say, we can't get all that figured out. Or if we did want to get all that figured out, it's certainly going to take us much longer to implement this. Let's go with the knowns, let's go with the known value that's already being delivered in certainly other markets and move ahead with that. Is it going to be the perfect end state decision? Likely not. And will it need to consider other sources of data and other industries? For sure. That's what I think it's going to be important, but I certainly welcome, and I'm sure many do, a reform of PIPEDA to account for consumer data rights more broadly. As you mentioned, we've certainly talked about my data is my data, whether it's banking data or health data, and a data portability right that allows me to share that more easily while being comforted in the protections that are provided through privacy legislation and obligations on security protections is very important.
So, where are we? Oversight by the central bank, read access by 2026, write access by 2027, generalized data portability rights. It sounds like there is a very exciting future ahead for Canada over the next few years. Let's close with a to-do list. What happens now? What is left to be done?
I think, AL, one of the million-dollar questions that is still outstanding is around the technical standard. Many organizations in the Canadian market, in the U.S. market as well, have built to the FTX standard as an example. They're building APIs, they're building consent frameworks, they're building user experiences with the only standard that really, really exists in North America. And there's certainly benefits for interoperability, end of plug for FTX from my perspective. But regardless of what the standard is, we need to pick it. If we're looking at a 2026 implementation, organizations need to know what they're building towards. And if it's going to change from what they've built to date, we need to know to make those modifications. So that's an important next step. Let's get that clarity. Obviously, moving to the next step for regulations, which we hope will come through in the spring, is very important. There remain open questions on the accreditation framework. What are the requirements and obligations on third parties in order to participate in the open banking ecosystem? your main questions on liabilities and dispute handling. Well, some of that clarity was provided. And the general principle that we've continued to hear, which I certainly welcome, that liability moves with the data is very important. There's still questions to be answered in terms of first point of recourse when an issue is raised by a consumer. And speaking of the consumer, clarity on how we're actually going to roll this out. What is the education process? How are we going to make sure that consumers understand that this is a good thing? So what is the consumer education aspect of this? And probably the last, because it's about consumers at the end of the day, I think it's important for all those that are involved in this to make sure that this is a trustworthy system. And accreditation certainly helps in there, making sure that the right entities with the right provisions for security and privacy controls and data governance are participating in the ecosystem. Ongoing monitoring is really important. Fraud is going to be a big one when we talk about payments. That is the piece that had one of the greatest challenges when you look at other markets that initiated payments through open banking. Fraud was the first challenge that really was experienced. And when that happens, you erode consumer trust. So I'll end with, I think that's a very important thing for us as an industry not to lose sight of and continue to collaborate to make sure that we've got the right protections in place to mitigate against fraud.
A bit of an emotional final question. Over the years, we have both seen many false starts in the Canadian open banking story. Have we got this time? Are we going to get there?
I certainly hope so, Eyal. And I love that you end with an emotional question. Here's my view. Even without all the great things that are happening from a government perspective, and I certainly welcome them as it relates to open banking, I think it's on us as the industry to do right. Do right by the consumers, do right by the Canadian economy, and continue to move ahead. Continue to collaborate on building APIs, on signing contracts, on moving forward with data being moved off of screen scraping and credential sharing. That's on us. I do feel the momentum is there. I feel that there's excitement. There's certainly far more activity than I've seen in several years. Yes, clarity is yet to be provided, but I've never seen this much excitement transitioning from what has typically been a constant fugue of disappointment it feels around open banking. As you mentioned, you and I have been at this for several years. It's nice to see the tide turn.
So we've got this.
We've got this.
Saba, once again, thank you for your time and for bringing us all fully up to date.
Thank you, Eyal. It's always a pleasure talking open banking with Mr. Open Banking.
Canada's open banking journey has been difficult. 7 years after that initial 2017 consultation, after countless reports and working groups, after tireless efforts to coordinate stakeholders, after growing frustration from the community, Canada finally committed to consumer-driven banking, passing its first real regulation in 2024. Some said it was too little, too late. When the second part of the act never materialized, they said, "I told you so." But here's the thing. Other countries have shown us what's possible. From the UK, we learned the importance of a strong central body to set the rules of the road, a role now assigned to the Bank of Canada. From Australia, we've taken the principle of broad consumer data rights that can extend beyond banking. From Brazil, we've embraced the need for swift, determined implementation in lockstep with our national payments strategy. And the US has introduced a whole new approach to technical standards, one that aims to harness the market's momentum and experience. Canada will take the best of these ideas
and add something of its own. A focus on fairness and resilience that reflects our values as a nation. There is still much work to be done. A concrete timeline must replace notional dates. A technical standard must be formally selected, and a delivery team must be put in place. But the road ahead is clear. November 4th marks the end of the prologue and the beginning of the real story. A story of innovation, competition, and consumer empowerment. A digital transformation that will reshape not just how Canadians bank, but how they interact with their entire digital lives. A story that positions Canada to compete and win in the 21st century. It's been a long time in the making, but the future of Canadian banking is open. And that future begins now.
Thanks for listening to Mr. Open Banking, the podcast that explores the ongoing evolution of open banking and its impact on our lives. Make no mistake, the rise of open banking is going to change financial services forever, and we will be covering that story every step of the way. This is your host, A.L. Savan. Until next time.
This episode of Mr. Open Banking was made possible by Ozone API, providers of the only API platform that supports every open banking standard in the world, unlocking the power of open finance. To learn more, visit ozoneapi.com.